The committee will come to order. We have minutes from the March 4th meeting. Representative Lane, would you move those minutes?
I will, yeah.
All right, the minutes, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting those minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Tao, will you move adoption of the division report on 2897?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion on that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The Senate file has been referred to us, so we're going to lay aside House File 2897, and Representative Norton will move House File 2897. Representative Norton will move Senate File 2596. That's how we have to do it, and then we'll put your language back in.
So moved.
All right. So that motion is before us. There is an A1 amendment, which is basically to put the language that passed out of the House Licensing Committee into the Senate file. So all in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. All right. So that motion is before us. Any discussion? Representative Abler.
Well, just for the voice of the future, is there a lot of differences in the House and the Senate versions of what they did there?
Representative Norton?
There were small technical changes. It was very similar.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, seeing no further discussion, and this is a bill that went through licensing, seeing no further discussion on that bill, and I understand passed unanimously, too, which is saying something. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevail. All right, so that one is, that was Senate file 2596 passed and went to the General Register. All right. So, House File 677, Representative Tao moves adoption of the division report on 677.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The report is adopted. Representative Bunn moves that House File 677 be recommended to pass and referred to civil justice. Is that
correct?
Okay. Any discussion on that motion? And this also passed out of, well, it was the licensing report. So, seeing no further discussion, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. All right. House File. I think we're going to go to House File 3151 first. Representative Lane. Welcome to the committee. Well, you're here. So, Representative Lane moves that House File 3151 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Okay, and first I would like to incorporate the A2 amendment.
All right, Representative Lane moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? I think it's just to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Lane.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill addresses a subject that we don't talk about very much in our society, the care of the bodies of our deceased loved ones. The purpose of this bill is to make a few changes in the statutes to help support home-based after-death care. First, a tiny bit of history. Several generations ago, preparing our dead for burial and funeral rites fell to family and friends. It was actually during the Civil War that a change began. Families wanted their loved ones' bodies sent home for burial, and that task, which could take many days, was helped by the use of a new technique, embalming. Gradually, embalming and undertakers became more common. But as we handed this final experience with our loved ones over to strangers, we became disconnected from this very natural and inevitable part of life's journey. This disconnect has left us with a gap in our knowledge and our understanding about death and about bodies, and we're always afraid of the unknown. So we tend to have the perception that every dead body is somehow dangerous or infectious. It is not. Or that we need to quickly call professionals to deal with it, to take it away. We don't. Or that the body needs to be preserved by embalming. It doesn't, and isn't really. And with this gap in our understanding, we don't have any idea what we've lost in a human or a sacred sense in the experience of this final passage. There are those who are reclaiming the experience of this threshold time and discovering it can be quite a transforming experience. You know, about 35 years ago, the baby boomers, of which I am part, began reclaiming the experience of another threshold birth, and not necessarily rejecting the help of professionals, but wanting to work as a team with them to reduce the use of drugs, to help the have the father be present, and now doulas, and in this process. So we've made childbirth a more human and sacred experience than my mother experienced by being put to sleep for her deliveries. Well, now we baby boomers will be aging and at some point dying. We and our children will be speaking more openly about death, looking for processes that are more interactive, more natural, and the less use of toxic chemicals. This is a very good thing. I myself participated in a 72-hour vigil after my friend's husband died several years ago. He was kept at their home, and the experience was quite amazing. It's hard to have words for it, so I'd like to show a few minutes from a PBS special called A Family Undertaking. The woman speaking lost her 7-year-old daughter when she was killed by an airbag at a low-speed collision. Matthew, let's see.
We care for our children in the case of child deaths, and they do occur, sadly. We're expected as a society to care for our children. We're required by law to care for them properly. And yet, for some reason, at the moment of the last breath or when the heart stops beating, we're expected as a society to then hand that care over to strangers. And that is unacceptable to me. And it was unacceptable to me when I had to make the very same choice. My daughter was killed very suddenly by an airbag in a low-speed collision, and she lost consciousness immediately upon impact and never regained it, and was pronounced brain dead within 24 hours of that time. And that's when the hospital told me that she could only be released to a funeral home, and I wasn't willing to do that. I wasn't willing to send her to a hospital morgue. I wasn't willing to send her to a strange place. This was someone I'd cared for from the moment she came into the world in every possible way. And I wasn't going to stop here. My daughter was 7. And we had her here for 3 days up in her bedroom, surrounded by her stuffed animals and her friends and her teachers and her grandparents and her cousins and aunts and uncles, and everyone could take as long as they wanted to say goodbye. And that was important. She'd left very suddenly, and we needed that time. Allison's older brothers were in the car when the accident occurred. And having her here at the house helped them accept what had happened to a tremendous degree. It wasn't as if, well, where's she gone, and when are we going to see her again, and all of that. She was right here, and they could talk openly about it, and I think not to have things shushed up was extremely healing and helpful for them, because there's a lot of joy in their memories of her, and it will serve them for the rest of their lives. When a family really wants to keep someone at home for a while, but the nurse involved actually thinks that she's being helpful by calling the funeral home for the family. And the next thing you know, they've got a rattling gurney at the door, and they come in with their body bags and zip it up and put someone you love inside, and out they go out the door and tell you you can bring their clothing later on when it's convenient. And all of a sudden, your house is empty of this thing that has caused you so much pain and grief. Whereas if you stay here and stay involved, there's an amazing silence and beauty that begins to enter. And that, that contrast of those two situations of having someone you love be taken out the door by professionals or keeping them at home, and the contrast in the feeling of those two situations is exactly why I do this work.
I would just like to say that I appreciated working with so many on this bill, including the funeral directors, and I want to emphasize that though we've opened the option of using dry ice instead of embalming, it is an option. No one is required to do it, neither the funeral homes nor the consumers. It's about choice, and I think that over time there will be an increase in consumer demand, but that's the way it should be. So I have a woman in the audience here, Heather Halen, who had this experience this fall, and she would like to tell you her story.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here today as a woman who is grieving the death of her husband.
And if you could just say her name for the record, I'm
Thank
sorry.
Thank you. Yes. I'm Heather Halen.
Thanks.
From Minneapolis. But not only am I a woman who's grieving the death of her husband, I am here as a woman with cherished memories, not only of the life that we shared together, but of the days immediately following his death. When he died, I took the time I wanted just to be with him, got a basin, washed his body, then dressed him in his very favorite bright sweater. Together with the help of others, we very, very tenderly, very respectfully moved his body from the bed into a plain pine box that two of his friends had so carefully crafted for him as a gift to him, and put that casket on the enclosed porch of our home. That night, I did not sleep well. But each time I awakened, it was so very special to be able to walk the few feet to the porch, to gaze at Gary, as I had done so often when he had slept, and to speak to him my personal words of farewell. Throughout the next day and evening, friends and family came to visit. Those who wanted to were able to spend unhindered, unhurried time alone with Gary and to visit with me in a relaxed fashion in the comfort and familiarity of our living room. There was absolutely nothing eerie or weird about this. It was a peaceful environment. A CD of our favorite Swedish hymns, even though Gary was Norwegian, was playing. Gary looked so good. Gary looked handsome. Two days later, a few of us gathered as the cover was placed on the casket. We each pounded in a peg to seal it, and carried it to a neighbor's work van waiting for us in the driveway. As I rode in that van to the cemetery, I couldn't help but look back and think Gary would have loved this. He would have loved that he was riding with a friend, and he would have loved that he was saving money. Gary was a very frugal man. Gary, in his life, embodied the very meaning of the word simplicity. And each step of this process, I felt, was so in keeping with his values and the way he had lived his life. The graveside service was what you would call very traditional, as was a memorial service 3 days later when our church was full of people remembering Gary. In no way would I mean to imply that this is the right way to do things or how things should be done. I had cared for Gary in his illness, and I wanted to be the one to continue to care for him after his death. I do believe that his spirit, his soul, left when he breathed his last breath, but his body was still there. And not only had our souls and spirits been meshed together, We had walked hand in hand, bodily, throughout our marriage, and taking care of his body did feel important to me. In fact, it felt like a continuation of the intimacy we had shared, almost a continuation of the commitment we had made in our marriage vows to be there until we were parted by death. And that death to me meant not only, as I indicated, his spirit, but also when we had to finally part physically. Living without Gary has been the most difficult thing I've ever had to do. But I am immensely grateful that the way I was able to say my final goodbye to him was the way I chose, was personal, was meaningful, and was the way which felt right for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if we could just hold questions for a couple.
Yes.
There. And Dr. Michael Osterholm will now speak about whether or not this is an infectious problem.
Afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Michael Osterholm. I'm the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. I come today before you as an expert witness related to the potential risk that this type of procedure might pose to loved ones or other those who might handle the body of a deceased person. Let me at the outset say I congratulate the committee for taking on this important issue and hopefully dispelling a great deal of misinformation that often is prevalent in the community about someone when they die. Generally speaking, across the board, there is no risk at all of a dead body, regardless of the cause of death, actually transmitting an infectious agent to someone after the time they die. I say generally because there are rare exceptions during an autopsy when the body cavity is actually opened in someone who has tuberculosis, for example, and you put a high-powered saw through the chest bone of the lungs, there's a potential for actually re-aerosolizing Mycobacterium bacteria into the air, not in the home setting as been described here. It poses no risk. In terms of blood-related issues, for most blood-related infections, after the person dies, the agents themselves die very quickly, and more specifically, there isn't that ongoing opportunity for bleeding activity as much as you would see, and again, in an autopsy setting. So, in short, there really is no discernible risk, despite often what is public information to suggest to the contrary. One of the major problems we have today in dealing with disasters often is the misconception that dead bodies pose a serious health risk, and because of that, they're handled in oftentimes an unfortunately very disrespectful way, when in fact that is an old wives' tale, that dead bodies pose a great risk even in times of crisis. So I would just tell you today that from an infectious disease and public health standpoint, there is no concern about the bill that's before you, and as a one who has loved ones, I would think that this would be something that would be a very positive step forward in how we deal with the issues of death and dying.
Thank you. And I believe that there's a funeral director that would like to just emphasize the choice element.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Jorgensen, and I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association. One of the big changes that we've seen in how we care for our dead over the 20 years that I've been in the funeral business is that just as you saw in the video, many times death would occur, the hospital would call the funeral home, we'd immediately go to the hospital or to that nursing home, go to the home and bring that individual right back to the funeral home. Things have changed. People want to keep their loved one either at home for a little while. Parents keep that infant child that's died at the hospital and maybe stay overnight. We may wait hours for somebody, a son or a daughter, to come from a distance to view that individual and spend some time. And part of that is because we want to take more ownership and an active role in the death of our loved ones. Part of the reason we wait is because people choose cremation and we don't always have those visitations and the open casket thing times that we've had in the past. And we certainly want to thank Representative Lane for taking this on and allowing us to work with her in some of the language here. And while the doctor's right, the dead body may not pose any health risk, you know, to society. One comment I would like to make is about the use of dry ice or extended periods of refrigeration in place of embalming when we're going to have an open casket public visitation at the funeral home. Just as we want to give consumers choices, we as funeral home operators and owners want to be given the opportunity to make sure that we can make choices on how we run our business. Death happens lots of different ways to lots of different people. And while the body may not pose a health risk, we still at times do have bodily fluids that, you know, maybe from the mouth or the nose. Many times there's odor. And as a business owner and operator, it may be in our best interest to say, if somebody's been refrigerated or packed in dry ice for 5 or 6 days, we would prefer not to have an open casket visitation in the funeral home, just for some of the problematic reasons that there are. And that still gives the consumer freedom of choice as to who they may use, who might let them do that in a funeral home. We would certainly be more open to doing that in the individual's home versus maybe in the funeral home, that type of thing. But just as we're giving the consumer freedom of choice, you know, we would also like to be able to develop policies on, you know, when we would have an open casket public visitation with or without embalming. Thank you.
Thank you. I would just like to clarify why Minnesota became more restrictive regarding embalming 3 years ago, because people ask, you know, what happened here? Well, there's a nationwide burgeoning business, for-profit business, which you can only describe as trade in fresh dead bodies. So they may give the family the impression that they're a non-profit, academic or research entity like our U of M and Mayo truly are. And then they can obtain the body free and proceed to make a great deal of money off it, usually in pieces. And it may be for academic things, training incidents, but they would be for profit, not the non-profit situations that we have here in Minnesota. So when we made embalming restrictions tighter, we discouraged their doing business in Minnesota because they don't want embalmed bodies. But the unintended consequence was to harm families who want to care for their own dead more naturally and more lovingly. And I worked with all the concerned parties to fix this part of the bill, at the same time rebalancing the needs of both these situations. So if you have any questions now, we could take them.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lane, for bringing this bill forward. I think many of us, if we looked back into our family photo albums, would find pictures that where, you know, from the early 1900s where family members displayed their families in their homes after they died, and people often took photographs of that. My question is for your first testifier, and thank you so much for sharing your story. It sounds like you had a wonderful relationship that many of us would aspire to, and thank you for sharing that. I'm wondering if you encountered any difficulties when you decided to do this, and if you had to receive any variances or what the process was for you.
Ms. Haley.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I did not. I feel I had done my homework. I had attended an informational meeting. I had read some literature and knew the process and procedures that I should follow, and so I did not meet any obstacles.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
she
would tell you that she wishes that more people had been able to come, because the law does restrict it to a private viewing with family, and we just opened it up last year to very close friends, but and it even had restricted minors, which would be up to 17-year-olds. So she would wish that it would have been open more beyond what she did have.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you said you went to a public meeting. I have a friend who went through a similar experience in Wisconsin, and they did a lot of work on the internet. They found a lot of information on the internet. Is there a particular organization that you notified, or how did you find out about it?
Ms. Haley.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I'd like to defer to you on the names of the organization. It's Minnesota Threshold Network.
Network
some members
is one
in the
of
audience.
The organizations that is working on this, and I believe there are additional ones as well. Yeah, there are national ones, and then locally there's the Minnesota Threshold Network.
Thank you.
Which you can find online and on your fact sheet here.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lane. I just want to say also thank you for bringing this forward. As many of you know, I represent a very diverse community that has people from all parts of the globe, and our traditions are not necessarily the traditions of all, and this will allow many of them to feel much more comfortable in doing the rituals and procedures that are more typical of their culture and their heritage and the way that they honor people in saying final goodbyes. So thank you for that. I do have one question, though, and the wording kind of eludes me, and that is on lines 2.13 to 2.15. It says, an unlicensed person may arrange for and direct or supervise in a memorial service if that person or that person's employer does not have charge of the dead human body. And I'm not sure why we have employers noted here. If it's for funeral industry staff, they would not have control of that either.
It's a unique situation, and I had that concern when I first was looking at the bill, too, and we were going to change that whole thing. And then I discovered that there is such a thing as a funeral planner, a person, a celebrant, a person who wants to help you plan a fantastic funeral, but now it's nothing to do with the care of the body. And so this made it possible for them to do a funeral because it had been more restrictive on who could actually do a funeral.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lane, well, in the spirit of the bill, though, I've seen memorial services take all kinds of different forms. And so I don't know why we would even have a limitation on who could do a memorial service. To me, the service is not a preparation of the body. It's not. I'm not sure why we're even limiting licensed, unlicensed for the service part. I understand if you were going to be, you know, embalming someone, obviously mm-hmm. you should have the right training or whatever and that kind of thing. But I'm just not even sure why we have a limitation on who can do a memorial service, where for some people that may be just a gathering of friends around a shared meal. It may not have to be a traditional thing. And could you tell me a little bit more about why we even have to have a designation on that?
If you look back on 1.24, we refer to the list of people that can have control of the dead body in terms of their relationship. I think that list is further down the line here. On page 7, you start with the person who has been named in an instrument, or the spouse, or the adult child, or the surviving parents, or the siblings, and you go on down the list. And the very last one that was added last year is a very close and dear friend, an adult who has exhibited special care and concern for the decedent. Now that allows those people to take charge of the dead body and to do a memorial service, to do as they need to, as they wish to. The thing that we have to add there is non-compensated, so that they're not forming another business to compete with funeral directors without having to be licensed. If you're going to act like a funeral director, then you need to go through our statute for licensure. So the only exemption is that person who wishes to assist in a big celebration doesn't have to be licensed, doesn't have to be one who has the right to have the care of the dead body in the family and friends, but can be paid to set up a memorial service. So that's the difference.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lane, I think you could achieve that same goal if you deleted that whole first sentence under F. So it only deals with the dead body and not the memorial service. I've been to many memorial services in which there is not even cremated remains. But you shouldn't have to worry about licensed and unlicensed to have that. And so I'm just wondering if the goal is the second sentence, which is an unlicensed person may not take charge of the dead body unless, et cetera. But that first sentence just controls who can have a memorial service. And to me, that is a...
Well, the key thing there is being paid to do it. If you're being paid to do it and you're not licensed, then you fall under this. If you're licensed, you may do it. If you're not being paid to do it, you're part of the family hierarchy, you can do it. This just takes care of that third realm called not licensed and being paid.
Representative Laffer?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll let others respond. Okay. I still need to think about that.
Okay. Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Dr. Osterholm. Mm-hmm. Representative Lane, I was sitting here. This question just came to me. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward so, you know, there's other cultures could benefit from this. At the same time, I know of one culture where some of the funerals last from Friday afternoon into Monday morning. Mm-hmm. And it's open casket for the whole time. Mm-hmm. And I'm asked the doctor, if we don't embalm this particular body, is there medical risk or there's some risk to the folks who come to view the body?
Dr. Osterholm.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Again, once the person dies, the infectious agents that we would be concerned about typically die too. I gave examples of the tuberculosis bacteria that would take an autopsy to require it. There are other organisms in the body that do not die, including ones that basically are what we call gas producers, those resident organisms in the gastrointestinal tract. That's where you see dead bodies bloating over time. Basically, they're creating gas, much like you'd see in a can that was improperly heat treated, and there are materials in there that create gas. So the only issue that really relates to any kind of biologic function with time is, would you have a body that would basically produce the gas, become disfigured, and potentially even have a rupture of that intact body? That's not a health issue. That would actually be an issue of where you might not find it pleasant, but we wouldn't be concerned about that as a health issue. So the longer the body is actually dead, the less likelihood that any kind of organism of a disease-causing kind would be a threat. So that's not a problem.
Further questions? Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Osterholm. That kind of brings up the question for me. Why do we need, really, even need to have the dry ice or the refrigeration? You know, I mean, what I understand you to be saying is it's really a matter of aesthetics and your taste, I suppose, whether, you know, what you can tolerate in terms of that. But if it's not a medical issue, should we even be requiring refrigeration or dry ice?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my family would tell you I'm not at all an expert on aesthetics, I'm not sure that I'm qualified at all to comment on that issue. I can comment on the fact, though, that it is not a medical issue. I think that most experiences would suggest that if you didn't slow down that natural biologic degradation process, that it might become a very unpleasant situation. But that's not a medical or a public health concern. That's an aesthetic issue. So I can't comment yes or no on dry ice. I guess personally I would want that only because part of the experience you're looking for and want to have is one where it's a natural setting as possible, and a body that becomes bloated or disfigured because of gas production from non-disease-causing bacteria surely could challenge that experience.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
We do have in law now that you don't really need anything for 72 hours. But you can't, as the law is now, you can't have a public viewing under those circumstances. So we're just saying that if you're going to have a public viewing, you should do some sort of preservation, such as dry ice. And if you go past 72 hours, up to a maximum of 6 days, you can use dry ice instead.
Any further questions on the bill?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment. I would like to really thank all the people who helped with this bill, and I'd like to give a special thank you to Jack Heckelman, whose life and death inspired me. So with that, I renew my motion for House File 3151 as amended be passed and sent to the General Register.
Okay. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Who is doing 773? Representative Fritz? Okay. So Representative Fritz will move that House File 773 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. And she also moves the DE1 amendment to get in the order she'd like it. And she will incorporate on page 1, line 7, after clauses, insert a parenthetical 2. So we're adding clause 2 as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor of the DE1 motion as modified, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And this is a bill that Chairman Atkins, pardon me, has authored, and I'm also a co-author. I'm sorry that he is not able to be here to present this and has asked me to do so. And I have with me Mr. Tennyson, too, who will be speaking to this. The bill clarifies that a company that sells health insurance products, things like supplemental medical policies that pay a fixed amount for each day a person is hospitalized or cover a particular kind of cancer, are not considered health carriers. They are therefore exempt from Minnesota health plan laws unless specifically directed in statute. And as I said, I do have Mr. Tennyson here to go over the bill and to help me with questions if you have any. So I'm going to turn it over to him if you would like to.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Fritz. My name is Robert Tennyson. I'm attorney in Minneapolis, and I represent Aflac Insurance Company in this matter. The reason the bill is here is because over the years, as the laws have been developed, the definition has gotten rather confused and convoluted. We have to go through about four different sections of the statute to figure out what the definition is. And the indemnity-type policies that we're talking about are not health plans, they're not group plans, they're not health insurance per se. What they are is they provide a certain fixed benefit based upon what it is that the person is required. For example, if you have a hospitalization or a supplemental hospital policy and you want $500 a day, you buy $500 a day, you go in the hospital, you get $500 a day to pay your bills, pay your hospital bill, make up your lost wage, whatever. The check goes to the person. And what this does is clarify that provisions of the statutes dealing with health plans, which are group plans and other things, although we're technically within a definition, our products are technically within a definition, there's no practical way to apply it. So what we're trying to do is clarify the definition so that when we talk about a health plan, it doesn't include things that shouldn't be there. We worked out this amendment with the House Counsel, Senate Counsel, and the Department of Commerce who signed off on this amendment. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but basically it's a clarification.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Tennyson, since the Delete Everything Amendment puts in all kinds of new references and statute, I'm not sure what it covers and what it doesn't. Can you tell me if this will, if reserve requirements, solvency requirements, price regulation, consumer protection under the commerce laws apply, or which ones are they, which current provisions in law will they be exempted from, and which will they have to comply with as opposed to a health plan?
Mr. Tennyson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, all the insurance companies that operate in Minnesota have to comply with the solvency rules and so on. We're not exempt from any of those rules. I'll give you an example of how this works. There's a section dealing with disclosure of payments for health care services. But we don't pay for health care services, but yet we're in the definition section, and we're trying to make sure that somebody doesn't get confused about that. Another example is tracking references for health care reimbursement documents. We're not in that business. We don't offer anything that has any practical, to which this has any practical application. Yet, because of the way the definition has been developed over the years, and I can go through the sequence of those if you want, but it'd be pretty boring. It doesn't make any sense that this should apply. So what we're really trying to do, we're not getting out of anything, and the department is very concerned about that, too. We have to comply with the consumer protection laws and all that. That doesn't exempt any of this. This says that, it makes it clear that our products, that the law that covers health plans, which are generally group plans and other things, do not apply to an individual policy that simply is a supplemental policy.
Representative
Loftus. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear the ones that do apply. I know you said some of them that don't apply. You said solvency is covered, but are rates review covered? Are consumer appeal and complaint processes covered? Are, you know, what does still remain as oversight of these policies?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leffler, everything remains except what's excluded right here. And what's excluded here is listed in the amendment. Right now, a health plan, for example, as opposed to a health plan company, a health plan is defined and excludes things that are listed here. For example, limited to disability income, number one. Number four, designated solely to provide per diem and so on. Eight and nine are specifically are currently in the existing statute for a health plan, and this sort of tracks that. It's mostly everything is applied. All the statutes dealing with solvency, qualification of product, loss ratio, things like that, all apply. It's a cleanup provision.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just one more follow-up. I didn't hear you mention anything about consumer protection, appeals, those kind of provisions. You mentioned financial ones.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, well, they still apply because they're not exempted here.
Okay, because, I mean, I'm sorry, the amendment just gives us a bunch of numbers and statute, and I don't have the statute books in front of me or memorized, so I'm just trying to get a sense of what applies and what doesn't. And one last question, why do you think it's important to call these health policies when they're really income supplements? They really don't cover health coverage. They don't, as you've explained them, they don't cover treatment of a disease. They really just give you a check that you can use to pay your mortgage, you can use to pay anything that you might encounter in your life, whether you were healthy or not. It just, you only collect, as I understand it, if you're sick.
Mr. Tennis.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure we had a choice in being called a health plan. I think that was something the legislature did, and in the definitions of a health plan and then later in a health plan company, we just got caught up in it, and it wasn't as probably carefully analyzed and thought out as it should have been when it was done up front. We're just trying to clarify it.
So, Mr. Tennyson, so these products are covered by other insurance laws dealing with the solvency requirements and those kind of things?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, yes, sir.
Okay. And so why are we accepting, so 62A is the health plan law?
Mm-hmm. 62A, health plan definition, Mr. Chairman, is found in 62A.011. Subdivision 3.
So we're
tracking for health plan companies some of those exceptions.
Right, and I understand that. So 62A.021 is the loss ratio provision for health plans. I'm just confused. It doesn't cover specifically solvency requirements. Maybe that's covered under a different insurance law. So why are we including 62A.021 loss ratio as something that actually they're subject to? Is that not covered in the other insurance law?
Mr. Chairman, there's some question about that.
Okay. So this is just to make sure that we're covering it both ways. I got it. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I pulled out the book here, and I'm sort of trying to, on the fly, go through and look up the sections. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mr. Tennyson, I guess I'm really uncomfortable with this, and my discomfort is not so much that I'm against what you're trying to do, is that I can't really understand it on the fly here, and I'm uncomfortable passing a bill that I know so little about. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, I'm kind of surprised, because I know that you've been lobbying for quite a few years, and I haven't been spoken to about this bill, and I haven't received any handout on it that I'm aware of, although I have to say that I don't always get through all my mail, but I mean, did you have anything that you handed out to any of us that kind of explained what you were trying to do, or, that gives tells us what these various provisions are or anything like that. I've been trying to both look at the book and listen to the conversation at the same time, but I must say that I'm not yet really ready to vote for this bill.
Mr. Tennyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I did not prepare a separate handout for this. I have a multi-page summary of every statute that cites the health care plan or health plan company, and we analyzed it, but it's pretty detailed. I understand your concern, because every time I'm asked to look at these statutes to figure out what the definition is, I look at a definition of a health plan company, which is found in section 62Q.01. That leads me to 62A.011 subdivision 2, which in turn leads me to 62A.01 subdivision 1, which in turn leads me to 68.06 subdivision 5A, before I can figure out where I'm at. And what we're trying to do is clarify this so we don't have to go through all that nonsense. The assurance I can give you is we've spent several months on this, working with Tom Pender from the House Counsel, Chris Stang of the Senate Counsel, who are also concerned about unintended consequences. We also worked with John Gross and others from the Department of Commerce to make sure that they're satisfied that this is not doing anything untoward and that it does what we say it does. I mean, I can't say much more than that, Representative.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I share Representative Liebling's concern about not understanding fully. I mean, I don't understand what the problem is if we don't change this law. I mean, what is the problem that your clients have run into under the existing law if this is just, quote, a clarification? Because that seems like it strengthens one aspect or another. And it seems to me I'd actually prefer to have this come back under the statutes that deal with, like, disability replacement income, because this is really an income replacement, it seems to me, or supplement. It is I would not want to see any of these products marketed under the term health plan, even if they are legally allowed to do that right now, because I think that really misleads consumers, who many of whom are desperate to try and get some kind of coverage. We've read news articles about people who've been misled because they don't know how to ask the right questions. And so putting it under a statute for health plan where it isn't going to cover specific health conditions, it isn't going to do reimbursement to providers, to me is we're helping mislead the public by putting it there. And I know you didn't choose to put it in those statutes where it is right now, but I really think a different approach would be better. But perhaps you can offer some clarification of, if this doesn't go forward at this point, what harm might be done to consumers in the marketplace or to your clients or others.
Mr. Tennyson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, problem the consumers will benefit from this amendment because it clarifies what's covered and what's not. We don't advertise as health plan companies. We don't sell our products as health plan companies, health plans. They're sold as supplemental policies. So we want to make sure that that's clear. The second problem is, in meeting with the department and going over all these definitions, they recognize that the definition include a lot of products that aren't intended. They don't try to enforce that against them, but that doesn't mean that somebody might try to bring a lawsuit trying to apply some inappropriate provision to these kind of products. And that's really what it does. It's covering that particular situation. And also, in the future, when we have a solid definition for it, when you draft new legislation, it makes it clear what it is you're talking about, because instead of having to go through six statutes to figure out what the amendment is, what the definition is.
President Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Tennyson, you're before the Health Committee. And if the Health Committee can't understand a provision in law that is just a listing of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, or unless otherwise specified, statutory references in four lines, then your description of that this bill clarifies the situation for the consumer doesn't work. I think your second position, which is, well, this would prevent a lawsuit that's trying to expand on it, seems to be the real potential issue. And I'd just say, if our goal is to clarify the situation for the consumer, I'd really welcome you to come back, and I'd be glad to work with you and others about putting it in its own place in the statute books and not under health plan companies. Because I agree with you, it isn't a health plan, but it ought to have its own sort of definition then of what it is, and not just reference a whole string of statutes that may or may not apply.
So my understanding, the way I read the legislation is that it doesn't apply to a health plan definition doesn't apply to these four items, right, except that the protections listed after that do apply to those four items. And that is to align it with what is written otherwise in statute. There's confusion in the law. So in one place in our statutes, it says one thing and excludes these things from the definition of health plan. But in other places, it doesn't do that. And that's what you're trying to accomplish?
Mr. Chairman, that's right.
That's right. Yep. Yes.
Notwithstanding the fact that I think you're probably right, Representative Loughlin, we should do a bigger fix on this, which is what I think you're getting at, mm-hmm. which is that we should just redo all our definition of health plans, right?
Mr. Chairman, I would have you undertake redrafting, you know, the entire insurance code.
Yeah, there we go. Okay. That is really an issue for the Commerce
Mr. Chairman,
Committee.
Because realistically, that's what several of these chapters ought to be redone, but it's a monumental task.
This is what I think might be helpful, is to actually do what Representative Liebling was suggesting and have the place where it is, where the law says it's this way, side by side with the place where the law says it's this, and maybe that's very difficult to accomplish. But I think if you could lay those two things side by side, people would have more comfort with this bill before we get to the floor. It is going to the Commerce Committee next as well, if we pass it. Representative Fritz.
Well, that's what I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm thinking that in the Commerce Committee, that's where we would be able to align that with that and do it there. I could get it there.
Okay. So other discussion on the Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I can see time's going away here, but a lot of these, if I think these objections are valid enough, and I think that the author is not going to ignore them, and who can't be here, by the way, but it's going to his committee, and I think it's reasonable to pass it on and let them work on it. It's otherwise it's not going to get past deadline, and I'm sympathetic to that issue.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you, Representative Abler. I mean, I guess that was something that Representative Loeffler was sort of trying to get at, like, what's the urgency here? Because, you know, unless there's some real reason that this you know, I appreciate the issue about deadlines, but, you know, how important is this? And I'm not getting a sense of that from you, because mm-hmm. what you just seem to be describing is sort of issues that probably have been around for a long time, and you know, I'm just not really feeling the urgency here, and I don't have the kind of comfort level to sort of say, let's just, you know, sort of do it on faith because it's so important. I mean, can you sort of, you said something about you're worried about lawsuits. I mean, is there, I assume that this has been this way for quite a while. Is there something that's changed recently?
Mr. Tennyson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it has been this way for a while, and has been working to try and figure out how to solve the problem, and we tried a couple different approaches to figure out which is the most efficient way to do it. And I'm not quite sure, in terms of the request to put this side-by-side with something, I'm not quite sure what I'm putting side-by-side with.
Well, you seem to indicate that the law was written in one place, in part of the statute, and this is trying to match up with that part of the statute, and so that's what I think we're confused about.
And the selection of where this went was recommended by counsel for the Senate and House.
Okay, I think we're all right. I guess I think the big concern here is that you're trying to get out of some regulation by not being regulated as a health plan, and we don't have a good sense of what you're trying to get out of, and we're afraid that you're trying to get out of things that are going to protect consumers or things that are going to keep, well, basically protect consumers. And so what are you trying to get out of by doing this?
There's nothing that protects consumers. What it tries to get out, take us out from under is statute says is the one that's several pages of them. We went through each one to figure out whether they have any practical application. Our policy, if we have mandates, for example, to do things that relate to health care, we don't do pregnancy. We don't provide medical care, that sort of thing. We get caught, because you use this broad definition, we got caught up in all this other stuff that has nothing to do with these products. And we're just trying to clarify that. We're subject to all the consumer protection laws that still exist. We're subject to all the laws governing the financial requirements, solvency, and all that of the companies. We're subject to having all of our products approved by the state before we can sell them. We're subject to loss ratios on the payouts of the policy. We're subject to the consumer protection laws that govern all insurance. Whatever it says is that we aren't subject to provisions that make no sense because they don't work on our products.
So you're selling a disability policy, and you don't want to be subject to a mandate that you also cover pregnancy?
Yes.
Is what you're talking about.
That kind of, is that type of an example. Mm-hmm.
Further discussion on the legislation. Okay. Seeing none, Representative Fritz will renew her motion that House File 773 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Commerce Committee. Or, unless some people want to do it without recommendation, too, I'm fine to do that.
As long as I get there.
Representative Loughlin.
Mr. Chair, I'm just not comfortable passing a bill that we still haven't gotten a straight answer what it gets us out, what it gets them out of. And so, even without recommendation, I guess if Representative Fritz is willing to say to Representative Atkins that we need a much clearer product and a standalone product, I mean, it's hard when you're carrying a bill for some other author. But I don't want this rolled into some omnibus insurance bill that comes out of Commerce and we can't see what happened and what didn't, and I'm not convinced that these are health products. These are income products, and I don't think they belong in the health plan statute. So I will vote no, but if other people want to move it on, I just don't think it's ready.
And I think he's trying to, I think Mr. Tennyson is actually trying to get it out of the health care statute. The problem is it got captured accidentally in the health plan statute. And I would imagine Mr. Tennyson would be willing to work with anybody to get all these products entirely out of the health plan statute. But that may be a more complicated thing to do, is what I'm hearing.
Mr. Chairman, you would need a lot of resources to do that.
Right. So, and I think, you know, if you want to share that list of things with Representative Loughlin, Liebling, and whoever else wants them, I think that might, you know, not right now, or you can right now, but. So, then Representative Fritz amends her motion that House File 773 as amended be passed on to the re-referred without recommendation to the Commerce Committee. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.